What a surprise to see you all, to see you all here. And it seems as if we are off to a brilliant start. I was really moved by the strong chanting this morning in the service. It went so beautifully, like a chorus of Buddhas. Very quiet, too, in the Zendo. Seems like we've already been here for a week. This is a very powerful and experienced community of practitioners. So thank you especially to our Enos and our Doan Ryo, and all of you for the strength of this practice. We are really ready for this session. And it's always a pleasure for me to be here with everyone. It really is. So I want to thank all of you for coming, especially all you dear ones, you know who you are, who have come from very far away. We really appreciate that. And it's great to see you in person. Not that we don't like seeing you on the screen, but it's really special to see you in person, as they say, in person. And we're in a great spot here that has been made very potent by the many sisters who over decades and decades of worship and prayer have consecrated this place to spiritual practice of the utmost seriousness. So we're going to do our best to honor and preserve what they have left for us here in these rooms and halls and corridors. And not only do we have this great place, but we also have the mighty Pacific, and we have the wide blue sky. And as if that weren't enough, we have this great tradition handed down to us generation after generation after generation by countless numbers of wise and dedicated ancestors in India, China, and Japan. And we have one another. And we each have our own body and mind. In short, we have everything we need for a session and more. And we've already begun well. So all we have to do is keep it up. Thanks for everybody. There's so much I know. I don't really know, but I think, I'm told, and it's apparent that there's so much effort that goes into making this happen. So thanks to the registrars, the Enos, everybody who created this session. And thanks to the sisters of Via Maria del Mar for their gracious welcome and the way they take care of us. It's precious doing session. The vast majority of people in the world have never heard of session. And of those who have heard of it, the vast majority of them would never think of doing it. So, to be born in a human body, to hear about session, and then to conceive of the idea that you'd like to do it, and then to actually do it, this is exceedingly rare. And maybe this has occurred to you already, that what we are doing here together this week really is awesome and rare. And we are very, very lucky to be able to do this. Really, really lucky. And if we were to just suspend all of our activities and each one of us collaborating maybe with one another were to make a list of the many causes and conditions that made it possible for us to spend this week here, we would spend the entire week on that list, and we would not even begin to exhaust it by the time the week is over. So I'm saying all this just to remind us all that this is really, really special. And even more so, since there's nobody here who knows for sure whether you will ever do Sesshin again. For some of us, this may very well be the last Sesshin. For any one of us, this may be the last Sesshin. Really, literally, the last Sesshin. So all this to say, let's make the most of it. Let's be serious about it. When I say be serious about it, I don't mean be grim about it or put on some big musty bag of seriousness on top of your head and walk around breathing that musty seriousness. I don't mean that, because as we all know, there's so much joy and lightness and happiness in Sesshin. What I mean is, very simply, don't goof off. Don't goof off. Pay attention. All the time. When you're sitting, when you're walking, standing, lying down, when you're eating, when you're resting, when you're working, when you're asleep, when you're washing your body, pay attention. Be here. Don't let your mind be muffled in the usual musing. Come back all the time, to where you are, to what you are, to who you are. And I mean who you actually really are. And I think that this week we would all like to realize who we really are, what we really are. And I think we would all like to understand this week what we have never understood before. And I don't mean understand some idea or some concept, some teaching, something that we could explain to our friends. I mean understand something about our being human together in this world, something that runs deep in our body and heart, a feeling about our living that we have never felt before. Lots of us, some of us anyway, have practiced quite a long time, many decades. We've been to lots of sessions, and maybe we think we know what to expect. But even for those of us in this category, maybe especially for those of us in this category, we need to make a special effort to be fresh with every moment of practice. So in the Dharma, you know, experience counts for nothing. It just gets in the way. It's just a problem if you let it be a problem. Because none of us has ever experienced this session before. None of us has ever experienced this moment before. And we all should make our best effort to meet it with our eyes and our arms wide open. Dogen famously speaks of body and mind dropping away. This means body and mind just here as it is. Not me, not mine. Not the body and mind that I'm used to and that I take for granted as myself. The body and mind that appears here suddenly. So let's help each other to experience this. So don't worry about the schedule. Don't worry about the arrangements. Don't worry about anything or think about anything. Just do your best to pay attention to where and what you are at every moment. And if you can take care of yourself that way, it will be the best way to take care of yourself, and it will really be the best help that you can give to every other person, to help them to take care of themselves in the same way. It is such a convincing thought, you know, that we are somebody and we came here to do our practice. But that's not really right. We are not quite who we think we are. And we are not doing our practice. We aren't doing the practice for ourself. We're doing it for all sentient beings. Even though we're so used to that phrase, doesn't even mean anything anymore, but that's the truth. We're doing it for all sentient beings, not because we're so idealistic or altruistic, but because that actually is the only possible way that you could do practice. If we were to follow through with this idea that we're practicing for ourselves and realizing for ourselves, it would just be more problems. Just the other day, during morning zazen, I was thinking that it's kind of odd that we fell into this custom of chanting the four great vows at the end of zazen every day. We chant them at the end of Dharma talk, and maybe the point of that is that we would like to think that we're being inspired by the talk to become bodhisattvas, and so we chant after the talk. But why chant after zazen? And I thought, well, why don't we chant the four great vows at the beginning of zazen to dedicate our zazen to saving all beings, ending all delusions, entering all Dharma gates, and completely disappearing into the Buddha way, which is our actual self. So I'm not recommending at all that we change our daily practice. I like the way we do it. But I am recommending that maybe for this session, you think about silently, privately, at the beginning of every single period of zazen, chanting the four great vows to orient your period of zazen. And when you chant them, to really mean them. Check your heart and mean them as much as you can. To dedicate every period of zazen to the great quest to realize and manifest and understand what we have never before realized, manifested, or understood. So maybe you don't feel like doing that, which is fine, but you can try it out and see if it's worthwhile or not. But anyway, whether you chant or not, you begin after that, let's say, with checking your posture very carefully. We all know, I think, the points of posture, how to lengthen and open the spine, gently stretch the back part of your head. My teacher used to say, pretend there's a thread coming down from heaven, lifting you up like a puppet. Stretching the back part of the head up and then tucking the chin in so that your nose is not pointing up at the ceiling. And you can lift here at the sternum. And then you actually can feel in the upper part of your body a kind of floating feeling, a lifting feeling, even as the lower part of your body is very grounded. And let the shoulders be back and relaxed. And the arms also relaxed in a little circle. So there's a little bit of space between your arms and your body. And the mudra of oneness, left palm on top of right, in a beautiful oval with the thumb tips just touching. Resting this mudra in your lap, just about at the place a few inches below your navel, maybe two, three inches below your navel, where you can feel the energy of the breath and the energy of the earth coming and going right there in the center of your body. And the mudra can, the thumb tips can touch your belly there, just a little below the navel. The ears in line with the shoulders, the nose in line with the navel, as Dogen says. Mouth is closed. Lips and teeth are together. And the face is quiet. And you can notice this. You can breathe a little bit into your face so that it will relax. Because for once, it doesn't have to face any other faces. It can just be a face for itself. It doesn't need to make any expression. So that's a lot to notice, right? Take care of in the beginning of the period. So be very careful, especially at the beginning, to set all of that in line, and then gently and resolutely, not in a fussy or a picky way, because it would be very easy to get very fussy and picky with all these little things, right? But not that way. Just gently and with some resolve, remain in touch with your posture the whole time you're sitting. I've always been really impressed with Keizan Zenji's instruction to put your mind in your mudra. Place your mind in your mudra. Feel it poised and delicate. And put your awareness there instead of in your head, where it usually is, and all your various leftover bits and pieces of thoughts are circulating round and round. We always assure us and you, we assure each other that there's nothing wrong with thinking. Thinking is perfectly okay. It's not a sin to think. And that is, of course, absolutely true. But in Sesshin, we should be so much focused on our mudra and on our breathing and on the sensations in our body that the thought doesn't intrude very much. Because when there's less thought, there's less you. And when there's less you, there's more peace. And when there's more peace, there's more wisdom and understanding. So there's more happiness and there's a lot more love. And what do we understand? We understand as Kondanya understood when he heard the Buddha first speak, that what is born dies, and there is nothing whatsoever to grasp. Everything is free and unburdened. And we're living and dying along with everything. And that is what love is. And we're breathing. And it's lovely to breathe. And so naturally we begin focusing on our breathing. Sometimes we say we regulate the breathing so that it is smooth and deep and easy. And again, not fussy about that. not trying to control it or make it conform to some idea we have about it. Just really observe the breath lovingly, or maybe more than observe, just become the breath lovingly. And if we do that without any control, it's naturally going to be smooth and deep and regular. So we're paying attention to breathing in and breathing out, and just feeling how wonderful it is that we are still alive and we are still breathing. Sometimes the breath gets really, really slow and really, really quiet. And you notice there's this funny gap, big space between the inhale and the exhale. And there seems to be no time at all in that gap. And then sometimes in that silent gap, you can feel the pulsing as your blood moves, as it always does, through the body. Bump, 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 bump. Or maybe if you shift your attention a little bit, you can hear your heart beating. Thump, thump, thump. Your amazing little heart. Your best friend that has been beating non-stop from the very, very beginning of you. What a loyal and devoted soldier. Just keeps on going, no matter what. So you're sitting there, very silent, aware of this immense round of activity, this tremendous passion of being alive. And also you can feel the space around your body, the space that is literally continuous with your body, that extends infinitely in all directions. And you can hear the patient waves of the great Pacific Ocean rolling in and rolling out. Maybe it sounds like eternity. And after a while, you can feel the great rhyme and rhythm the ocean waves are making with the pulsing of the blood and the beating of the heart and the movement of the breath. You can feel it's one experience. Our usual way is to pay attention to the breath deep in the belly, even though, of course, we know we don't actually breathe in the belly, we're breathing in the lungs. But you can feel the breath in the belly as the belly rises and falls. But the breathing really takes place everywhere in the body. And you can feel that as you breathe. You can feel how, when you inhale, life and energy suffuses the body, and how when you exhale, peace. So we pay attention to the breath down there in the belly, coming and going. And if you want, you can count the breath on the exhale from 1 to 10 and begin again at 1, or begin again at 1 when you lose count. So you can keep coming back to the number one, or to the feeling of the breathing in the belly, or to the posture, or to the various sensations of the body, And when you notice you've lost track, you just come back. Come back home. Maybe you can even see how you are lost or why you are lost. But you don't dwell on that. You just come back. Our basic faith is that Zazen will take you where you need to go. So we're not trying to second guess it or control it or push it around in any way or make it do what we want it to do. We're just following Zazen where it leads us. And so we trust it and we keep coming back again and again and again and again. And if you have some pain or discomfort, and it happens, you pay attention to it, but also you balance it with other sensations in the body, like the breath, for instance, which may not be in pain or uncomfortable. And if you can do that, you find that you can sit okay, even if there is some discomfort. But usually, the discomfort will cause your mind to issue forth various complaints. Maybe you'll even get to the point of blaming someone. It's the Eno's fault. The Eno's did this to me. Or maybe you'll blame your own poor body for all this trouble. And then you will wish that the bell would ring now. But then you know it will not ring now. It will never ring. And that's when it dawns on you how stupid all this is and how foolish you are to believe in all of these thoughts and concepts that are themselves the pain that you're feeling. You see that. So little by little, you will learn, if only out of self-defense and self-preservation, how to stop complaining so much. Or at least, if you can't stop complaining, at least stop believing the complaints. Which is, in fact, a pretty big thing to learn in this life. And if you're lucky enough to learn that, you will appreciate it very much. So now I'm returning to the awakening of faith, where we left off last time, almost at the end of the third of the five parts, the third part being by far the longest part. We didn't get to the end, but almost. But this morning, I'm going to skip ahead. I'll go back to the parts I'm skipping over. But this morning, for today, I just want to go to part four, the title of which is On Faith and Practice. And it is a discussion of four faiths and five practices. And now I want to talk just a little bit about the fifth practice, which is called, because it's germane to where we are today, it's called the practice of cessation and clear observation. And those words are translations of the traditional words shamatha and vipassana, words I'm sure you're all familiar with. And they're often discussed as two distinct practices, but here they're mentioned as one practice. And that's how we understand them too, as one practice. Shamatha is calming the mind or concentration practice. And it seems as if in order to thoroughly be able to see with real insight, which is what vipassana is, you know, insight, in order to be able to have real insight, you need to get below the ordinary level of mental activity, which is the usual level of mental activity that for most people is the only kind of mental activity. Because it's fairly superficial and mixed up, and you won't be able to see anything as long as that's the way your mind is. So that's why you need a mind that's much more settled than that, and because settled, enriched. Not just calm. Calm is not really, doesn't touch it. It's not calm in the ordinary sense, but deeply, profoundly still, which is why shamatha can be fairly translated as cessation. So the mind is completely still. Everything in the mind is brought to rest. There are some kinds of Buddhist meditation practice in which you spend a long time just doing shamatha practice, maybe many years before you begin the practice of vipassana. But in our practice and in the awakening of faith, as I said, we develop both of these practices at the same time. We see them as one practice. So a lot of what I said before about posture and breathing and so on, that is basic instruction for shamatha practice. In all kinds of Buddhist meditation, you can hear those kinds of instructions. However, in the awakening of faith, the instructions given are somewhat different. Ashvaghosa is not recommending that you pay attention to the breath or to any other object of meditation. He says, all thoughts as soon as they arise should be discarded, and even the thought of discarding thoughts should be discarded. For all things, he says, are essentially already in the state of transcending thought. So there is nothing, in fact, to be created or discarded. If that seems a little hard to understand, think of it this way. Imagine that it's not you sitting there in your body. God has descended from the heavens and is now sitting in your body, seeing everything going on from a God point of view. And God is certainly not identifying with your thoughts or taking them seriously in any way. How could God take these thoughts seriously, right? As actual thoughts. God recognizes these thoughts as just some sort of natural reflex, almost exactly the same as the ocean waves, which are conditioned by things and they appear. Same with your thoughts. That's how God sits in your body, seeing your thoughts. So God would never engage these thoughts or be disturbed by them in any way, right? God wouldn't bother with discarding them. What's to discard, right? So it's kind of like that. That's what Ashvaghosa means. Anyway, he agrees that if the mind wanders, it should be brought back, but what should it be brought back to, if not the breath or something? It should be brought back, he says, to correct thought. Correct thought. And what is correct thought? Correct thought, of course, is what he's saying over and over and over again in Awakening of Faith. Correct thought is the thought that whatever is mind only. There is no external world. And there's no mind exactly either, because mind has no marks of its own. So, and this is a direct quote, it is not substantially conceivable as such at any moment. That's what you should return to. Which is why we instead return to the breath, because it seems a lot more concrete and easier to do than that, doesn't it? But if you think about it, it pretty much amounts to the same thing. If you consider your own thoughts, almost always they're thoughts of an external world. Maybe a memory of people or places, or a thought about oneself, as if oneself were an actually existing entity that's abiding rather than just a momentary experience after the other. And when you're returning to the breath and the body in Zazen, these are not things that you're returning to. They're experiences, present moment experiences that cannot be conceived of or grasped, but only experienced fleetingly. So when we gently turn away from thought, which is essentially always abstract, just the way, in fact, the idea of the external world is abstract, and come back to the immediacy of the body and the breath, we are exercising what Ashvaghosa calls correct thought. Correct thought is, of course, not another thought. It's the correction of thought. Next, Ashvaghosa says that a person should practice this not only when sitting, but all the time. All the time returning to correct thought, letting go of the external thought until finally the person can enter easily into what Ashvaghosa calls the samadhi of suchness. He then says, this can only be done by someone who has faith in the Dharma, someone who is not skeptical, not doubtful, someone who practices precepts, and so on. A person who doesn't do this will be incapable of entering the samadhi of suchness. This is telling us that what he's talking about here is much more than a technical matter of meditation, as if you could divorce meditation as a technical matter from everything else that you are. This practice involves a whole life, a whole approach and attitude. But assuming you have cultivated all that, you enter the samadhi of suchness, and then right away you develop the samadhi of oneness, which is the samadhi, he says, that sees all Buddhas and all Buddha realms as non-different from everything, this very world and everything in it. And then he says, that's the fundamental samadhi, and then from that samadhi, all other samadhis can be developed. Next, Ashvaghosa goes into all the ways this can go wrong, because there's lots of ways that this can go wrong. And now I will quote you at length his description of the various ways that this can go wrong. So if a person trying to practice this lacks the capacity for goodness, you know, and hasn't developed precepts and all these other things, they will certainly be confused by Mara, the evil tempter, or by heretics and demons. And sometimes these beings will appear in dreadful forms while they are sitting in meditation. But other times they will manifest themselves as handsome men and women. And in that case, the person should meditate on mind only. These are not real. And then they will vanish and won't trouble them any longer. Sometimes they may appear, these demons and so on, heretics and evil forces, may appear as the images of heavenly beings or bodhisattvas, and assume also the figure of the Buddha. How about that? You could see the Buddha. Be careful, right, if you see the Buddha. Furnished with all the major and minor marks, or they may expound the spells or preach Dana Paramita, preach the precepts, preach patience, zeal, meditation, and wisdom. In other words, they might appear as the Buddha teaching the six paramitas, or they may give Dharma talks while you're sitting there in Zazen, seeing these images of how true nirvana is the state of universal emptiness, of the non-existence of characteristics, vows, hatreds, affections, causes and effects, and of absolute nothingness. They may also teach you about the knowledge of your own past and future states of existence. Also, they might teach you how to read other people's minds and master speech, which will cause you to become covetous and attached to worldly fame. Because now that you can do all these amazing things, who knows? The sky's the limit, right? Or they may cause the person to be frequently moved to joy and anger, and thus to have unsteadiness of character, being at times very kind-hearted, or drowsy, or sick, or lazy-minded, at other times becoming suddenly zealous, and then afterward lapsing into negligence and developing a lack of faith, a great deal of doubt, and a great deal of anxiety, or abandoning their fundamental excellent practices and devoting themselves to miscellaneous religious acts, or being attached to worldly affairs which involve them in many ways, or sometimes they may cause the person to experience a certain semblance of various kinds of samadhis, which are all the attainments of heretics and are not the real samadhi that we're trying to get at in our text here. Sometimes they may cause the person to remain in these samadhis for 1, 2, 3, or even up to 7 days, feeling comfort in the body, joy in the mind, neither hungry nor thirsty, partaking of natural, fragrant, and delicious drinks and food, which induce the person to increase attachment to them. Or at other times, they may cause the person to eat without restraint, now a great deal, now a little, so that the color of their face changes accordingly. That's what Ashwagosa says. He concludes, for these reasons, the one who practices cessation should be discreet and observant, lest their mind fall into the net of evil. They should be diligent in abiding in correct thought, neither grasping nor attaching themselves to anything. And if they practice like that, they will be able to keep themselves far away from the hindrances of these evil influences. Well, stuff like that. I love stuff like that, you know. I don't know if you find it interesting, but I find it so interesting. When you think about it, it's really something, you know. In Japanese Zen, they used to refer to stuff like this as makyo, the various kinds of powerful experiences and visions even that can come to someone during sesshin. Sometimes they're, you know, very terrifying things that appear to you, but just as often as we see from the passage, there are wonderful things that appear to you. Sometimes makyo can come in the form of insight into the teachings and the feeling that you could have of a very powerful samadhi concentration, lightness of the body and joy in the mind that can go on even after the session is over for 3, 1, 3, 5, 7 days, he says. I never did experience that, but I've heard people have told me that they've had that very experience, that they went to sesshin, they had a powerful experience, and they were floating on air for days and days afterward. But Ashwagosa is telling us very clearly that this is not what we are trying to do, because all of this is characterized by a subtle belief in an external world, which is not there, and therefore a subtle attachment that in the end will lead to no good once the amazing effects have worn off. Because it is nearly impossible not to become attached to powerfully positive experiences and insights that we might have in intense zazen. And by virtue of that attachment, these things exactly become hindrances. Now, there is nothing wrong with powerful experiences that we have in our practice. In fact, we have them, and we really appreciate them because they encourage us. You know, if we just sat there and just, you know, it was crappy and we were in pain and nothing else happened, we would say, why am I doing this? You know, this is stupid. But no, we have these wonderful, sometimes they're scary, but they're noteworthy experiences a lot, and we appreciate them. Keeps us going. The trick is to see that, like everything else, even the most profound insight comes and goes. And there is nothing substantial in it that can be identified or grasped. It's really not any different from anything else that comes and goes. The main thing, as Ashvaghosa says at the end, is to remain present with whatever is happening and to practice what he calls correct thought, which basically means that you do not attach to or reject anything. You don't stick to anything. You're always there for the next moment of practice, whatever it brings. Anyway, he has a lot more to say about the practice of cessation, and then he has a bunch of stuff to say about the practice of insight, but that's enough for now, I think, more than enough. We'll get to that later on, I guess, if we do. Please forget all of that stuff and keep on with your practice. Don't go fast, don't go slow, just go moment by moment, steady, careful. Keep it up. Thank you very much.